Blog Talk Radio.
That's right, everybody. You know who it is. Coach Mike Jones on the coach with the most. Coming at you hard from coast to coast. I don't want to boast, but now I got to roast you in my social media posts. You double dose, undiagnosed. You feeling tired, life expired, now you're a ghost. I'll be your host, so won't you raise a toast to the coach with the most, Coach Mike Jones.
Welcome to another edition of the Coach Mike Jones Show podcast, episode 23. Yes, I'm proud and honored to have Lewis Rock back so he can tell us more about his story with the time with Roddy Piper. How you doing, brother?
Doing great, doing great. Thank you for having me back. It's an honor, as always. Thank you.
Yes, that has been my number one rated show so far. Episode 12 on August 20th of 2022 was the first show. Proud and honored that we had the exclusive interview, the first one that you've done about the Piper story. We're really honored to have that and really excited to hear more about it, especially since hopefully you'll be writing a book someday.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I've continued to put together in chronology some of the highlights of my time in the industry and time working with Roddy, and always enjoy talking about it and recollecting, I'm just humbled to hear that it was your most watched, or rather most listened to episode that you've done. I definitely didn't expect that, but it makes me happy to know that people out there enjoy hearing about my experience.
Definitely, and yes, we're here to hear more, and we could just rehash a little bit on where it all started. Yeah, I discovered you or found you at a wrestling show at Fort Lewis that was sponsored by 1-800-COLLECT. It gave you a flyer, and then on you went to Debashi School, got started there. Other significant things, I won my first title at your high school that you were currently going to, Gig Harbor High School, myself and Hank Miller versus you and Debashi with Playboy Buddy Rose in your corner. Then after that, you won your first title against me, the UIWA Universal Heavyweight Championship. My God, what a road it's been.
It has been just incredible to think back to that day at the 1-800-COLLECT show and wanting so badly to break into the business and finding out that there was potentially an avenue to doing that, and then how it all progressed and, you know, led to almost a decade straight of my involvement in the business, including, like you said, highlighted by, you know, my first title win and main event, both was with you. And then, of course, you know, we toured all over the Pacific Northwest together, sometimes friends, sometimes foe, but always a great time. And, yeah, learned so much, and it was the springboard that set off this career that I never could have imagined in the industry.
And that's kind of ironic, because the springboard drop was my finisher back in the day. So, wow, it all comes
that's
together.
That's right. It sure does.
All right. So how you been doing lately?
Good, good. Just got back from a vacation in the Dominican Republic. About to go to Ireland for Christmas. And, doing really well. Enjoying life. And, I'm about to turn 41 this month. just doing well and having fun.
Wow. Yeah, I think I met you when you were like 16 or something.
That's right. In fact, my professional debut, I actually had to lie about my age on my wrestling license application because I wasn't 18 yet.
Okay, yeah. You sure looked like it, though. My goodness. All right, so
yes,
let's get back to this interview. Now, there was some big happenings at WrestleMania 19, and that was in Seattle, and I was proud and honored to be there. Let us know a little bit about Roddy's return to the WWE at WrestleMania 19, and how did that go down?
Yeah, absolutely. So in November of 2002, we were on his book tour for his first book, In the Pit with Piper. And we talked last time about, you know, how that kind of culminated with an appearance for TNA that was unannounced. And so during that tour, Roddy had called Vince and, you know, left a message and said, hey, you know, I'm doing this book tour, 31 stops, 27 days, or whatever it was. And, you know, Roddy just had quite an enormous event in Times Square at the Planet Hollywood there for his book signing as well. And so, you know, it seemed like a good potential from Roddy's perspective, right? Let's call Vince and see what's going on. And so I remember it very clearly. It was Roddy had called him, and it was about a week later, and we were still on the tour, and Roddy is sitting in the back of the bus, and I see him motion for me to come back, but he puts his finger up to his lips, you know, like to say, you know, quietly, and which, you know, was his way of telling me, hey, come back alone and don't bring anyone with you. And so we sit down there, and Roddy immediately says, hey, I heard back from Vince. And I said, oh, really? And he said, yeah. And he pulls out his cell phone and plays this message. And, you know, Vince always called Roddy Hot Rod. And, you know, something to the effect of, you know, hey, Hot Rod, great to hear from you. You know, unfortunately, we just signed a deal with Simon Schuster. And so don't know that we can do any business together as far as the book is concerned. But I'm really glad you reached out, and I wish you all the best. And that was the gist of the voicemail. And so Roddy says to me, he said, we've got him. And I said, what do you mean? He just told us we can't do business together. And he said, no. He goes, listen to it again. And Roddy was stuck on the part where he said, we're not going to be able to do any business together as far as the book goes. And even though he didn't elaborate anything beyond that, just strictly saying, hey, we signed with Simon Schuster, and as far as the book goes, we can't do business. Roddy knew instantly, based on his history with Vince, and of course I had no history with Vince, so I didn't pick up on it, that was Vince's way of saying, hey, I'm open to business. And so ended up working out a deal through Brad Small and Jerry McDevitt. Brad Small is Roddy's entertainment attorney. Jerry McDevitt, of course, has been WWE's counsel for many years. And so culminates in coming to WrestleMania 19. And, and then they'll find out when we get there what the plan is for him. The rest was kind of history. It was a surreal environment, you know, backstage. Everyone, of course, very respectful of Roddy. And, I remember quite a few different interesting things about some of the wrestlers at that time and the state that they were in and kind of how they behaved. It was very, very interesting to be backstage with WWE, who we hadn't worked with during my tenure up until that time. But of course, you know, it set up a run of, I want to say maybe 6-7 months that we ended up working with them. So.
Right on, yes. And then I didn't think nothing of it because I remember back in 1999, you were backstage at the Tacoma Dome pay-per-view. And you got to meet a lot of those same guys. Did any of them remember you?
Yeah, so funny enough, it was Spring Stampede. I want to say maybe 1997, somewhere in there, WCW at the Tacoma Dome. And one of the things that, you know, I always knew was, you know, bring a tape. And WCW security, I knew was awful. And so I just showed up, and of course I, you know, I've got a big leather jacket, and I've got, you know, boots that are 2-inch lifters. So, I mean, I look every single part of a wrestler, and I just walk right up to the back gate, and I said, hey, I'm here to see some of my friends that work in the industry. And the security guy said, yeah, go right ahead. So just went in and started, you know, going around, and, you know, met Diamond Dallas Page. He was working out his match in the ring, and then, of course, Kidman and Mysterio were there as well. I remember Lex Luger and Scott Norton were in a heated debate about the greatness of Venus and Serena Williams, the tennis duo, but were both very kind when I asked them for a picture in the middle of their super heated conversation. I remember, too, opening a door, and Ric Flair was in there talking with, I want to say, Kevin Sullivan, a couple other people. And as soon as that door opened, Flair just shouts, get the F out of here. And so I'm like, oh, shoot. I remember I asked Scott Steiner if I could get a picture with him. And he was wrapped like, he had ice on his shoulder, ice on his chest, ice on his back, and had, like, you know, I want to say like 30 feet of ace bandage just holding, you know, no exaggeration, 7 or 8 different ice bags on his body. And he looks at me and he says, F no, you're not going to ever get a picture of me looking like this. But everyone else was, you know, really kind. In terms of whether or not, you know, anyone remembered me from that show, you know, this was WrestleMania 19 was 6 years after I had been backstage at Spring Stampede. So, and for different companies. So yeah, we had a lot of the same overlap talent, but most of the people that I knew with WWE at the time, I solely knew because of the, you know, having spent the last year working with Roddy and, you know, the overlapping that just occurs when you're in that industry.
All right, definitely. And do you have any more WrestleMania 19 stories?
Yeah, so it was interesting. Roddy and Hogan kind of had, as you might expect, like carte blanche creatively. And so, you know, we're typically like later times on the road when we were, you know, doing matches or appearances, you know, there would be an agent, usually Michael Hayes, kind of assigned to it. But I remember very clearly that we really only communicated directly with Hogan regarding what Roddy's involvement would be in the match. Now, I remember Roddy did go talk to Vince for a couple of minutes, getting him, all of a sudden, you know, they come in, they've got this enormous black leather jacket that goes all the way down, you know, to your ankles. And the way that the setup was on the baseball field is if you weren't going to come down the main entrance ramp, there wasn't a good place really at ringside to have, you know, a wrestler waiting in the queue, so to speak, to then jump the guardrail and get into the ring without being noticed. And so we were with Bruce Pritchard. It was me, Roddy, and Bruce. And Bruce takes us to this area under these bleachers that's a good 100 feet or so from the ring. And, you know, Roddy, of course, knew what part of the match would be his cue. However, he had to move very, very quickly once that happened because we were so much further back from the actual ring, you know. And Roddy, of course, you know, was known. He had his hip replacement, and, you know, he wasn't, you know, really in the habit of jumping a ton of barriers and guardrails at, in 2003. But, yeah, the whole thing worked out, and, you know, he jumped in and inserted himself in the match and then came back, and that started really about a six-month period with WWE doing different spot shows. He worked a program with Mr. America, the, you know, the Hulk Hogan's gimmick at the time. Yeah, so that's kind of how that started. I remember a couple things I remember about being backstage. I remember Scott Steiner would never talk to anyone and wore a black hoodie with it pulled up and almost, you know, covered his entire face. And, you know, over time, seeing Scott, he never would really talk to anybody. I mean, complete loner. But every time he saw Roddy, he would pull that hood right off and look him right in the eye and shake his hand. It was just so, so respectful. And I remember too the state of Jeff Hardy at the time. You know, we were all in a locker room area, that has, just like you see backstage, baseball, football, where everybody's kind of got, you know, their own locker, but it's a big open area. And Jeff comes into the room and sits on the bench and buries his head in his lap. And literally sits like that for like 3 hours. And so the whole time we're in this room and it's almost like he's passed out with his head in his lap. And then, you know, when it came time for him, I can't remember what his piece of business was that night in the ring, but when it came time for him to go, he was able to. But then as soon as he came back, once again, just right, plopped down and buried his head and didn't really move. And I remember it being so shocking to me that, like, something's clearly wrong here. And yet, you know, this is one of the top stars in wrestling, you know, across the world, but clearly hanging on by a thread. And so, you know, subsequently, of course, you know, his struggles, God bless him, have been well documented. But I remember that being shocking to me. Because I didn't expect it at all. So, those are just some of the highlight memories that I have of being backstage for WrestleMania.
Okay, and the next question is more than one part question. The HBO interview, how did it come about? How did McMahon get involved? How and when it aired, did it start a spiral that ended Roddy's termination?
Yeah, so great question. So when Roddy was on his book tour, one of the things that was a big message for him, and he talks about it in his book, a chapter called The Sickness, was basically the state of professional wrestlers after their glory day, right? Which is that, you know, you've been on TV for all this time, you've sacrificed your body, your everything, and then when it's time to retire or to do something else, you don't have really the skill set to do anything else other than, as Roddy would put it, you know, he liked to use the 7-Eleven analogy, where it's like, hey, once you're broken down, your body doesn't work, and all you've ever done is be a pro wrestler, if you want to do something else, like, what are your options? You don't have an education. You know, you can't do hard labor because your body's so broken down. So, like, what do? Go work at 7-Eleven, making $9 an hour? Like, and so the whole piece of it was one of basically, hey, wrestling has a great entrance plan, but it doesn't have a great exit plan. And so Roddy had partnered up, and I can't remember exactly how, with a guy named Father Jason Sanderson, who at the time was the second highest Powerball lottery winner in U.S. history. It was $66 million. And it just so happened that Father Sanderson, which, you know, is interesting, having a an ordained father winning the lottery is two things you don't necessarily equate with one another. But he wanted to make a retirement home where wrestlers could go and live and be taken care of, as opposed to, you know, just being left broke and with nothing. And so that was a huge part of his message was, hey, you know, we're independent contractors, but we're treated like employees, and, you know, they don't give us insurance. They don't take care of us. There's no retirement plan. There's no pension, you know, and at the time you could count on one hand the number of famous wrestlers who were able to retire off the money that they made. I mean, literally less than five. And so anyways, that was a big part of his message. Well, HBO had contacted us, Real Sports, HBO Real Sports, about doing kind of an expose on Roddy Piper, his career, who he is, you know, and not only as a performer, but as a man, as a father, as a human being. And wanted to tell that story. And then also, you know, they wanted to ask him questions about the state of wrestlers, how they were taken care of, so on and so forth. So, you know, they end up flying to his house in Oregon. They take footage of him with his family. They even, you know, set up scenes where, like, he's walking with his you know, I think she was five or six at the time, his youngest, you know, on the farm and you know, all of these different things. They interviewed him a few different times. When it came time to do the final interview with Armin Katan, one of the questions that Roddy was asked was something to the effect of, you know, how much responsibility does Vince McMahon have in the state of retired wrestlers today? And Roddy said, all of it. And so anyways, when they go and put the interview together to air, they don't use any of the B-roll that they took. They don't tell a compelling story about Roddy's life. What they do is this expose on the business, how awful it is, and then have Roddy front and center saying, it's all Vince McMahon's fault. Well, if you're employed with WWE, that's not a good look for you. And similarly, people might remember, they interviewed Vince for that story. And pissed off Vince, Armin Katan did so much that Vince tried to slap his interview notes out of his hand. Which he wasn't successful at, which infuriated him even more. But at the end of the day, WWE was so pissed that we had gone to Madison Square Garden to do a house show. It was Roddy and someone else in a tag match against Tajiri and someone. And, you know, Roddy gets the green mist in the face, gets pinned very quickly, and we get back to the hotel that night, and we have an email from Jim Ross terminating him effective immediately. And so when Roddy, you know, went years later and did his Hall of Fame speech, you know, the first line that he used in that speech was, is HBO here? As a joke, because that was the first time he had been back to really do any business with WWE since they had fired him for that HBO piece. On a side note, Roddy sued HBO after that. I don't know that I'm allowed to say how much money, but I can tell you that they settled for a substantial sum based on how they really just misled Roddy throughout on what the story was going to be about, including not using any of the footage that they had clearly only taken to make him think that this was actually, you know, a thing about his career versus a complete sham on Vince McMahon and WWE. So I know that was a little long-winded, but that's ultimately how that came about, and really led to Roddy's termination from WWE at that point.
Okay, yeah, and that was my next question on what led to the termination. Yes, let me double check here real quick. Why? So you basically answered that too. Yes, I do have a fan question here that I'd like to get to before, so we don't forget. They want to know, what's the biggest lesson you learned from your time with Roddy Piper? And is there something that you learned that you still use today?
Yes. The biggest lesson that I learned from Roddy professionally or from a business perspective was that when you take care of the business, the money takes care of itself. And I later learned in my professional career that when you take care of the people, the business takes care of itself. And so, you know, I built a career as an executive at a Fortune 500 company. I've been there almost a decade. And one of the whole foundation of my philosophy as a leader, as I manage about 2,400 people, is simply that. When you take care of the people, the business takes care of itself. And when the business is taken care of, the money takes care of itself. And so, you know, I've built a career on servant leadership and taking care of the people that work for you. And as a result, the business runs very well. From a personal perspective, the biggest lesson that I learned from Roddy was just how lonely it is when you're the best at something. And, you know, Roddy's favorite saying that he used to say all the time was, it's lonely on top. You know, and you think that when you get to the top of an industry or a profession or something and you're, you know, quote unquote, the best in the world at it, people don't realize how lonely that is because everybody else is gunning for you. And they will take you out to take your place at any time, even your most dearest of friends, you know, and it's like that old adage, you know, you're riding down the road with your best friend in wrestling, but if the choice becomes you get the top spot in your family eats or they get the top spot in their family eats, you know, at the end of the day, each is their own, and you can never forget that in that industry. And so I've seen how that applies to other areas of life and the business, and it was one of the things that made me sad for Roddy often was just how lonely he was because he was so great at what he did. So yeah, those are two main things. One of my favorite sayings of his that I still use today often, because I think it applies everywhere in life, is pigs get fat, hogs get slaughtered. And it's so true, you know. So, you know, from a perspective of applying greed and all of those things, right, it's always important to remember that if you're a pig with things, you'll get fat. But if you're a hog, you're going to get slaughtered. And so, you know, I could share Roddy quotes all day, but those are the ones that come to mind.
Wow, yeah. And on the other side of, like you were saying, being lonely at the top, what about all the stalkers and fans and those in between that were involved?
Yeah, so that's another thing that just, you know, blew my mind. You know, granted, I was, you know, started with him at 20, but age 20, but, you know, he had a stalker that had threatened his family, had been on his property. He had had, you know, protective orders put out. The guy had been arrested multiple times. And I remember one day we were in Oregon, near his family home, and we go into a 7-Eleven, Roddy liked Slurpees. So we always found ourselves at a 7-Eleven no matter where we were. And I can tell that something's off, and I just go and pay quickly, and we go out the door. And I, as soon as you get in the car, I see to Roddy, I go, what was that? You know, he didn't say anything or do anything. It just, something felt weird, and I kind of put my finger on it. And he said, I don't think he recognized me, but that's the guy who was my family stalker. And so that, you know, was quite interesting to know that not only has this, you know, has he had the stalker thrown in jail and multiple protective orders, and even to the point where, you know, he had protection for his family when he was gone as well. That was just crazy. And then another one that was so odd. So we were on the book tour, and we had, you know, done 31 stops, like I said, in 27 days. But we were on the East Coast, and we had gone from, like, New York down through Kentucky and into Georgia and Nashville. And this same guy had four kids all under the age of 8 with him. And after about 6 or 7 stops in a row, I'm like, this guy has been taking these kids across the country in this minivan and literally following us around. Like, why aren't these kids in school? And it was so bizarre. And then we would find him, like, watching the tour bus from afar, but at, like, 3 in the morning, where this van is in this parking lot and, you know, these kids are asleep in the back and he's watching. And it was just so bizarre, but it really educated me and opened me up to a world of, like, people can get super crazy when it comes to celebrities. And here's this guy that's just hauling all these kids around, 12, 15 hours of driving a day in this minivan, and very stalkerish. Sometimes, you know, they didn't even fully wait in line to, like, get autos or anything. They were just there to hang out as close to the table as they can be. But it was super creepy. And I'll never forget that. And, you know, we had others that would do, you know, 2 or 3, you know, stops here or there, but no one that, like, followed us across the country. So, yeah, very, very bizarre. But many instances like that with Roddy.
Wow, man, my goodness, Roddy held back and didn't want to rip that guy's head off when he seen him at the 7-Eleven. You'd think that's what might have happened, you know? My goodness.
Well, no, absolutely. And I think, I don't know, you know, there were a lot of people in the store that day, and Roddy was sure that the guy hadn't recognized him. You know, Roddy had done what he needed to do, you know, legally to have the guy held accountable. Very odd. I think that if we had been the only people in the store, that potentially would have gone quite differently. But, you know, there's also typically cameras everywhere. And, you know, if you're going to take care of
exactly.
a piece of business like that, the books, you know, doing it on full camera is probably not a great idea.
But the good thing is fate won out, and he did the right thing. And even to the length of the guy coming to the book tour, and he didn't lash out either. So I'm glad that story at least ended good.
Yeah, you know, Roddy used to always tell people, I always prefer to be a gentleman and a gentleman. But I don't have to be. But that was always true, you know, like all the crazy stories, you know, people hear about Roddy during his heyday and all of those things. You know, Roddy the man, he was very gentle, very loving, very caring. Like, he was not quick to violence by any means. Now, to protect himself or his family, probably quicker than anyone on earth. But just in general, not in any way violent or anything like that. And so, yeah, you know, he handled it as a professional and as I would expect. Interesting, though.
Exactly. And he was definitely one of the toughest wrestlers of all time with his background in self-defense. And then it was such a blessing that he was able to teach you a lot. What are some of the things that he taught you?
Sure. So one of the things that I found really interesting was part of being a handler for someone is not just about, you know, being a physical line of defense, but also things like making sure that they're recognized when they should be, but are not recognized when they should not be. And if you need to take someone like Roddy in this instance through a crowd where if anyone recognizes him, he's going to get mobbed. How do I stand? What are the angles? How do I walk? How do I move? How is my body tilted? What speed am I walking at? How am I identifying potential threats and moving them along? How am I also making sure that if people are getting too close or are, you know, being too demanding, that I don't put Roddy in the position to have to shut them down, that I, as the handler, you know, shut them down, and then Roddy says, hey, sorry, you know, he's the boss, got to listen to my team kind of thing. And so learning about angles, speed of walk, where to place yourself, how to place yourself, and then also how to get someone through different crowds, different types of situations. That was all very interesting to me in terms of like the physical aspect of it. You know, Roddy initially, we went and would go sparring 4 or 5 days a week for about 6 months until, you know, was by no means, you know, going to be a championship boxer at any point, but it allowed me to gain confidence in my own ability to not just take care of myself, but, you know, to take care of him should a situation like that come about. And so that piece in particular was very helpful. You know, Roddy was an ex-Golden Gloves champion in his teens, and so a very accomplished boxer. Also spent a couple months focusing on kickboxing as well, and then, you know, some close hand-to-hand combat. Yeah, you know, basically everything you would need to know to be effective at the job that I had, which was as his manager and handler. So, yeah, it was great. Really enjoyed it.
Awesome. What a blessing. And then, my goodness, what a lesson in keeping your head on a swivel and watching your surroundings. That's certain things that most people don't keep track of. You definitely need to in that line of business.
It's true, and the other thing, too, is that oftentimes threats aren't who or what you think, and they don't always advertise themselves the way that people think, right? Like, for example, if someone is going to stab you, they're not going to be holding a knife above their head shouting, I'm going to stab you, right?
Yeah.
They're going to blend in. They're going to get in close. And that they're going to strike at just the right moment. And so, you know, examples like that where, you know, you have to kind of not only learn who's a potential threat and why, but then learn how to also look out for it. And like you said, have your head on a swivel and identify it very quickly. And, you know, one of the first things that Roddy did when I started working with him was, teach me, you know, Carney, you know, beyond what I had learned in the independents. And, you know, Roddy was very well versed, of course, in Carney. and specifically in all of the carny words that are not English conversions. But one of the reasons that he did that was to be able to educate me real time. So like, you know, if we're walking through a crowd or I'm moving him from point A to point B, he could be giving me real-time feedback without people knowing that that was happening or understanding that that was happening. And so from an educational standpoint, it allowed me to get up to speed very quickly because, he could train me and give me real-world, real-time feedback without anyone else knowing that that's what was happening.
Awesome, yes. And it looks like we got a caller who's going to be calling in here shortly, but he had another question. You know who it is, but we'll wait till he gets on to reveal who it is. He wanted to know, did you ever spend time with Jean LaBelle through Roddy?
I did. So there was the roast of Jean LaBelle in downtown Burbank. And me and Roddy had our office and apartment at the Oakwood Apartments, which was right next to Warner Brothers Studios, right there in Burbank and just across the freeway from Hollywood Bowl. And so when it was time for the roast of Jean LaBelle coming into or being an event there, me and Roddy went, and it was a black tie event, and we got, our rented tuxedos and all of that, and went and participated in the roast for, it was 4 or 5 hours. And there were a couple other times just for meals and one-offs that I had met Gene, but it was really at his roast where we spent the most amount of time together. And so, just an incredible, incredible guy. And Roddy used to tell Jean LaBelle stories constantly, and it makes me so happy. The legacy, now where it's been passed on to Rhonda, who also trained with Jean LaBelle and who also was given the blessing of using the Rowdy moniker. It's just really fabulous. Roddy adored Jean in so many different ways. And really, really a huge, huge influence in his life and someone that he, never had anything but wonderful things to say about. It was great.
Okay, right on. And here we have him on the line right now. This guy started out shortly after you did, was a graduate of DeBasi School also. Mr. Feel Good, how you doing?
I'm doing fine, Coach. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Here's Lewis, ready for your questions and answers.
Lewis, how you doing, sir?
Good. It's good to hear your voice, man. It's been a long time since we were getting the 56-ounce lattes and going down to Sandy Bars.
Hell yeah, yeah. Staying up for a gazillion days. I mean, that's a big latte.
It was, man. Glad to hear your voice, and I've seen on Facebook that you're doing well, and that Feel Good is in full swing, and that makes me really happy. You look like you're having a lot of fun.
Oh, I am. I'm a little second lease on life. I was out of the business for 11 years, but I think I've had more in a condensed period of time. I've been able to knock off a few things that I didn't get to do in the prior life.
Well, good.
But I did enjoy our road trips, Sandy Bars, a lot of, like the old days of learning on the road, or just talking about things or what we learned, or man, next time I ain't gonna do that again or whatever,
Yeah.
I don't have any more questions. Coach actually asked you a couple of them that, I want to know about the Jean LaBelle thing. So,
yeah.
I figured you had a little fun there.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So I'm glad to hear that you're back in the business and doing well. And, So yeah, man, good for you.
Well, I got a show tonight with Northwest Pro. You know, I'm most likely going to do a little refereeing. I'm not managing anybody in particular right now. I bounce around and I'm, you know, ring announce, manage, referee, commentate, all that stuff. Just whichever company wants to book me, doing whatever they want me to book. I mean, I'm there. I'm loving it.
Well, good, man. It's your jack of all trades.
All right, Phil.
What's
before
up, Coach?
We let you go, before we let you go, do you have anything else you want to plug or promote, or how do people get a hold of you?
You get a hold of me. Get a hold of me on Facebook, and if anybody can't find me on Facebook, they know how to find you. You know how to find me. You know, always ready to rock and roll. Just give me a call and tell me where to go.
All right, thanks, brother. Wish you all the luck in the world and have a good show tonight.
Hey, Lewis, good talking to you. Much love and respect, and maybe one of these days we get together for a coffee.
I'd love that, and it's really good to hear your voice and that you're doing so well, man. Take care and good luck tonight.
Much love. Thank you. Peace out.
Thank you.
All right. There's a little flash from the past right there. And all right.
Holy
so
cow.
Some other things that some people would like to know. What were Roddy's favorite movies?
Yeah. So, Scent of a Woman with Al Pacino. Probably watched that movie at least 100 times. I mean, probably once a week for 4 years. He really liked Apt Pupil. Had Brad Renfro and Ian McKellen in it, about an ex-German soldier that perpetrated, you know, Holocaust crimes, that was in hiding in the United States. And this high school kid ends up uncovering him. But it's called Apt Pupil. Another one, The Green Mile. Man, we had that. We had rented that at the time, right? VHS, DVD was just coming in, and so The Green Mile was on two VHS tapes, and he loved that movie. Watched it all the time. And funny enough, Miss Congeniality was actually a movie that he just loved as well. And so when I think about, you know, the movies that he would always come back to, it was just really a handful of those. Outlaw Josie Wales was one. That's an older movie. And then Michael Collins. Oh, man. Michael Collins with Liam Neeson. Loved that movie. In fact, and that today is still one of my favorites. Watch it all the time. Those were his favorites, though, that we definitely didn't go anywhere without a copy of all of those.
Man, and you'd think that, I don't know if he would be really watching them, but some of my favorite movies of all time, They Live and Body Slam, you guys weren't watching those very often, huh?
So one thing about Roddy didn't watch his matches and didn't watch his movies. He had no interest whatsoever. And you know, I think there was one time that I was able to get him to sit down and watch his match with Bret Hart at WrestleMania 8 with me. But no, outside of that, you know, I even asked him, you know, a couple months in, once it became clear to me that he didn't watch his own stuff, I said, have you ever seen any movie that you've done? And he said, They Lived, because of the premiere that he had gone to, that he had seen. But outside of that, he said, I haven't seen any of the movies that I've done. And same with wrestling. You know, he would never go and watch matches that he had. He had no interest in it, and would be fair to say he didn't enjoy watching himself. Yeah.
Wow, that's interesting. And, you know, a lot of people are the same way. You know, you'd hope that he was watching They Live, but no big deal. Now, what about when he watched the Bret Hart match with you? Did he go over it with you, or did you have questions about the match with him, or you guys just watched it?
Sure. So part of the reason why was, so I had told Roddy multiple times that, like, hey, you know, your match with Bret Hart, like, unbelievable. And so, you know, I bring that up every now and again. And so Roddy, you know, he had told me individual stories about different parts of that match, like the finish, for example, and how that came about. You know, why did they do the sleeper hold, turnbuckle kickoff, pin combo? Like, how did that come about, number one? He also liked to talk about, he also talked about how that moment in the ring where he picks up the bell and the crowd, you know, he described it as like this hush comes over the crowd where it's like you can hear them or feel them telling you, like, no, Roddy, don't do that. And, you know, he looks at it, he looks at them, and, you know, it's kind of this drawn-out moment of emotional attachment with the crowd. And, you know, he eventually ditches the bell, and you know, they go on their way with it. But then he had told me those couple of stories a few different times. But then I had asked him, I said, you know, there's a spot in that match where Bret does a cross-body block, and you're against the ropes and y'all tumble out of the ring. However, it looks like you made a mistake. And he said, what do you mean? And I said, well, initially you start to go through the top and the middle rope and then quickly correct yourself over the top rope. And I said, so, like, what happened there? Like, did you make a mistake, or, like, what's going on there? And he said, well, I don't really know. I said, well, let's watch it. Come on, let's watch it. I got it here. Let's just watch it. And so finally, you know, we did. And he said, yeah, you know, I just it was just a small mistake. Corrected it. No big deal, kind of thing. And then, you know, retold the bell story and then how they landed on using the finish that they did, you know, because Roddy's, you know, torn between, you know, I don't do jobs, but Bret Hart's my cousin and really needs a rub here. So how do I accomplish both of those things? And it was Roddy's idea for that finish because, you know, since Roddy had the sleeper hold on Bret first, when Bret, you know, pushed off the ropes and was on top of, had his back on Roddy's chest, pinning his shoulders down, the referee should have checked the arm for Bret three times since that was the initial hold. And then, you know, provided it wasn't, you know, a drop of the arm on the third and the match is over, then move to the secondary, which was the pin, and count that. And so in Roddy's mind, it was a way where, because the referee just went straight and counted the pin, which was technically an error, it allowed Roddy to save face from a, hey, I didn't lose cleanly, the ref made a mistake, while also, you know, getting Bret over and the title on him and so on and so forth.
Wow, man, thank you for the insight on that. Now, what was his favorite music?
Sure. So he loved Gaelic CDs. So, you know, in Ireland, you know, the Gaelic language, some of his, great grandparents potentially, but some of his ancestors, according to him, had spoken Gaelic, and he had grown up, you know, around people that spoke Gaelic. And so he really enjoyed Gaelic music. Now, granted, I had no idea what they were saying, of course, because I didn't speak Gaelic. Roddy seemed to understand most of it quite well and played it consistently. He also really liked Hank Williams. Seven Spanish Angels, the Ray Charles, Willie Nelson. That was one of his absolute favorites. The Foggy Dew that Sinead O'Connor sang has, you know, the Irish bagpipes and accent and all of those different things. I think it's Conor McGregor's theme song, in fact, today. Those were the ones that he had on pretty consistently. Working Class Hero as well, I believe, is the name of a song by John Lennon that he really liked. Very diverse taste in music. There's even that one song, I can't remember who sings it, but Little Boxes, Tiny Boxes, and They're All Made Out of Ticky Tacky. That song, he loved that. He would sing that all the time, even on his own. And I don't know what it was about that song, but that was kind of his taste in music a bit. So hopefully that answers.
Okay. Definitely. And then what was his favorite food and drink?
So if he was drinking alcohol, Grey Goose vodka with cranberry juice. Absolutely. That's what you would order if we were drinking consistently. If we weren't, he drank Evian water and could drink like a half gallon at a time, in one dip. Like, you know, you give him one of those big 2-liter things of Evian and he'll chuck the whole thing. So those are the two things, right? If it wasn't Grey Goose vodka and cranberry, it was Evian water. From a food perspective, Roddy loved tuna, sashimi, sushi. Anytime that it was available, we would go and he would just order a ton of sashimi and would eat every last piece of it. I mean, sometimes enough for like 3 or 4 people, just insane. And then when we used to order food, there's this Italian restaurant called Bocelli's down the way, and he would order chicken parmigiana every night. So it was either sushi if we were going out or chicken parmigiana if we were staying in. And then if we're on the road specifically, filet mignon. Or salmon from room service was always what he would eat when we were on the road and in hotels specifically.
All right, nice. And then what was his favorite book or an author?
Sure. So Roddy has shared publicly that he only had a 6th grade education and suffered badly from dyslexia. It impacted his ability to read efficiently. He wasn't someone that you would find, you know, reading a book, so to speak. But there's, Rudyard Kipling, who wrote The Jungle Book, many other works. There's a poem that he wrote called If, and Roddy loved poem. In fact, he even had me print a copy of it and post it in our California office. It's basically kind of a rundown of humanity and life lessons put into a poem. And for whatever reason, it always really touched Roddy. You know, some of the lines from it were things like, you know, if you can keep your head when all others are blaming you, but make allowances for their blaming too. Adages like that was the gist of it, but he loved that poem. In fact, he mentioned it to me in the first convo that we ever had, setting up my time working with him. He brought up that poem.
Very cool. So what drove Roddy Piper, and did he like the fame?
Yeah, so what drove Roddy Piper was giving his family the best possible life that he could. He didn't like fame. He didn't like being recognized. However, he appreciated it because it's what allowed him to feed his family. But if Roddy had had any other way to feed his family that didn't involve him being famous, he would have snatched that up in a heartbeat, no doubt. And so the thing that drove him above all else was taking care of his wife and kids. They're the world to him. The reason that he stayed on the road literally until the day he died was to continue providing for them. And, you know, when you wake up every day and you have one goal, and that goal is to, you know, provide for your family who you love more than anything or anyone else in the world, that's what drove Roddy. And so, you know, it didn't matter if his wrist was broken or he had cancer or his ribs were busted or whatever. Nothing was going to stop him from the pursuit of taking care of his family. And so that is still to this day one of the things that I cherish the most about my time working for and friendship with Roddy was the way that he loved his kids and the way that he loved his wife was just so pure and so beautiful, and it guided everything that he did. And that was just an incredible thing to be able to see and witness firsthand, because, you know, second place was way down the list. Like, family was everything, and especially those kids. And so, yeah, that's what drove him.
Okay, yeah, that was my next question. What did Roddy consider to be his most important legacy?
His children, no doubt.
Yes, definitely. And then, yeah, I know we're getting low on time, and we do got some more questions here. Looks like I'm going to have you rescheduled on Turnbuckle next time on a Sunday, where I'll be able to join, since last time you were on Turnbuckle was on a Friday, and my schedule doesn't make it so I can make the Friday shows. But what do you got coming up, and would you like to plug and promote anything?
I mentioned last time, you know, I do run an eBay business selling baseball cards, both raw and graded. And so you can always check me out on eBay. It's Rock On Inc., R-A-C-H, and then underscore on, and then underscore Inc., I-N-C. You know, at any given time, I've got between, you know, 250 and 500 cards up for sale, and do pretty regular business, and also do a lot of buying. So if you're interested in any of that, definitely, you know, feel free to check it out. Otherwise, I don't have anything to plug. Just really appreciate the time and the opportunity to come on and talk about my experience with Roddy. And one thing I will say, if you haven't gone and gotten access to Vice TV to see Tales from the Territories or Dark Side of the Ring, those are two shows, both on Vice TV, that are absolutely incredible if you're a fan of professional wrestling. And so if you haven't seen those, definitely go check them out, Dark Side of the Ring and Tales from the Territories. In fact, grappler Len Denton was on 2 weeks ago talking about Portland wrestling with Princess Victoria and Kevin Sullivan and a few others. So, but yeah, great show.
Yes, awesome. I love that show. And yes, definitely check that out. And how else do people get a hold of you for interviews or something?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm on Facebook. I'm on Instagram. I'm on LinkedIn. It's just Lewis, L-E-W-I-S. And then my last name, Rock, R-A-C-H. You can contact me on any of those platforms, no problem. And happy to take additional bookings. And again, like I said at the beginning, it's just an honor that anyone would want to hear about my experience, and I really appreciate it. And I'm more than happy to talk about my time with Roddy, my time in the industry, and shed some light on what a wonderful man he was, and what a great friend and father that he was as well.
Yes, definitely. Yes, it's been an honor and privilege to have you on. We appreciate it so much. We do have other questions written down that we documented that we will make sure to get to when we get you on Turnbuckle, and I'll work on getting you scheduled here shortly. Thank you so much.
I wish you all the luck of the world.
Thanks, Lewis, so much. Appreciate it.
Yep, thank you. I'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Have a good one. See ya.
That's right, everybody. You know who it is. Coach Mike Jones on the coach with the most. Coming at you hard from coast to coast. I don't want to boast, but now I got to roast you in my social media posts. You double dose, a diagnose. You feeling tired, life expired, now you're a ghost. I'll be your host, so won't you raise a toast to the coach with the most. Coach Mike Jones.